Please be seated.
Thank you very much. You are very kind. You stood up. I thought you were leaving. Before we get started, I want to ask you to take off your Republican or your Democrat hat or your liberal or your conservative or your independent cap. Take off those caps and put them on your knee or just kind of put them there on the floor. And I hope you'll listen to me tonight to hear what I'm saying and not listen to me to respond. You know, as a father, I often have to remind myself to listen to my kids to really hear what my kids are saying as opposed to listening to my kids to respond to what they're saying. And there's a big difference. And in politics, we like to do that. And a lot of times people in politics, in the political arena, when we're dealing with current affairs, when we're dealing with the issues of the day, a lot of times when the facts contradict what we want to believe, we ignore the facts. We ignore the facts. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late senator of New York, I heard him say once there in Washington, he said, in Washington, we are entitled to our own opinions, but we're not entitled to our own facts. So often when the facts contradict what we want to believe, we ignore the facts, especially in politics. Friends, we're living in interesting times in 2005. We are experiencing things today and we're seeing things happening right in front of our very eyes that never in my wildest dreams growing up in Eufaula, Oklahoma did I ever think that we would be talking about some of the things that we're talking about in terms of current affairs, in terms of where our nation is headed, in terms of where we're going as a country. Fascinating times. I was on a radio show last week and I was talking to the host and he said to me shortly after I'd gone on, he said that there was a restaurant. He was talking to me about this restaurant that you go in this restaurant and they wear no clothes. And I said, help me, Rhonda. What are we coming to? Restaurants with no clothes. Now, I'm still old-fashioned in that sense. I want people to have clothes on when I go in a restaurant to eat. But interesting times that we're living in. And I think the pressing question for us in 2005 America is there's two questions. One, what are we going to do to equal that World War II generation? They gave us the freest, most prosperous, the healthiest, most wonderful nation there is, that World War II generation. What are we going to do to equal the World War II generation? And the second question is, what are we going to do to create the kind of future that our kids and that our grandkids deserve? You know, I've got grandkids today, and I find myself over the last couple of years, our oldest grandchild is 3 years old. We'll be three March 21st. And you know, it's interesting, I think a whole lot about that these days. What kind of future do I want for my kids and for my grandkids? What kind of America do we want over the next 20, 25 years? Do we want an America that's going to be able to compete in a global marketplace with two serious challengers, China and India? Over the next 20, 25 years, China and India will emerge as serious, serious, serious global players. And we will have to compete with them. If we want our kids to inherit a free and a prosperous and a healthy America, we must take a look at the systems that we use in 2005 America to govern our nation. You know, friends, we use these old, tired systems, these old, tired models of government, that they are inefficient, they are wasteful, they're non-productive, and in the private sector, we would have junked them 30 years ago. But in the government sector, it's a fascinating thing that we say that, you know, we want different results, but we do the same old thing, the same old way, and we expect different results. If you do the same old thing, the same old way, you're going to get the same old results. And I think if we are to compete with China and India, if we are to stay ahead, we've got to look at our systems. We've got to look at our government models. We've got to look at the model that we use in terms of education. Friends, education is the quickest way I know, or the best way I know, to do what we talk a lot about in politics, and that's level the playing field. But we also have to understand, you never level the playing field. If you have some kids that go to schools on a daily basis that teach them how to read and write and do the arithmetic, and they gain the computer skills necessary to compete in a global marketplace, and some kids don't. The federal government literally forces kids to go to schools that don't work. And friends, when we have kids that walk across platforms or walk across podiums or platforms on graduation night in May of this year, and they can't read the very diploma that they've gotten when they walk across the stage, we have literally crippled those kids for life. So again, we must hold education systems accountable. We must say the most important tool, the most important asset that God has given us, the most important treasure that God has given us are our kids. And our government uses models that they force kids to go to schools that don't work. About 4 to 8 years that I was in Congress, I offered amendments to education bills that would allow poor parents, give them scholarships so that they could send their kids to the school of their choice. It was defeated, but at least the Speaker of the House gave me a vote on those amendments. I remember one of the times that we offered an amendment to try and get that happen, to make that happen. I had one member of Congress, she said to me, she said, poor people should not be able to live in public housing and send their kids to private school. I said, no, wait a minute, let me make sure I'm understanding this. It's okay for presidents to live in public housing and send their kids to private school, but poor people can't live in public housing and send their kids to private school. We do it on a college level. You know, we do it on a college level. We allow kids to apply for Pell Grants, and we say, you can spend that Pell Grant wherever you want to spend it. We did it with the GI Bill. We said to those soldiers, to those veterans, you can take this $30,000 or $40,000, and you can go to Harding University, or you can go to Arkansas University, or you can go to Oklahoma University, or you can go to Oklahoma Baptist University, or you can go to Oklahoma City Community College, you can go to Notre Dame, you can go to Southern Methodist University, you can go wherever you think you can get the best education. Why is it that when we say that we want poor people to have that choice, say, no, can't do that? If you give poor people the choice of where to send their kids to school, they're not going to choose JC's school. That is an indictment on JC's school in itself. To say, if you give Dr. Burks a choice, then he's not going to choose my school, he's going to choose somebody else's school. Friends, why are we afraid of competition? Competition is a good thing. You know, the fact that we have... Look, I've got 45 minutes. When you applaud, that takes my time. Don't applaud. I bought a tractor for my ranch about a year and a half ago. And because I had a phone and a fax, and I could call more than one dealer, I saved, comparing apples to apples, I saved from $1,500 to $7,500 on my tractor. I called 4 different dealers. I said, this is what I want. You send me your best and final offer. Here's my fax number. People were competing for my business. In the private sector, if you don't like McDonald's, if you want a hamburger and you don't like McDonald's, you can go to Burger King. If you don't like Burger King, you can go to Tasty Freeze. If you don't like the Tasty Freeze, you can go to Wendy's. You have a choice. If you don't like Ford, you can go to Chevrolet. If you don't like Chevrolet, you can go to Toyota. If you don't like Toyota, you can go to Honda. If you don't like Honda, you can go to Chrysler. You have a choice. and the government we don't. And it hurts you, the taxpayer, the consumer. Man, taxes. And friends, let me tell you something. I'm proud to tell you there was never a tax bill that crossed my desk that I didn't vote for. And I didn't vote for a tax bill. I never voted for tax relief because I was a Republican or Democrat because of some party affiliation. I voted for it because I live it every month. And I know there are people in this country that every month, about the 20th or 21st of the month, they find that they have more month than they have money left. About the 21st of every month. Working people in this country pay 50 to 58 cents of every dollar they make in some government tax or government fee. And I find it fascinating that people continue to say to me, we don't need tax relief. No, nobody wants tax relief. Friends, let me tell you something. If you want to get in a short line in life, you get in that line of Americans that believe that they're undertaxed. Nobody believes that. Now, I think there's a role for taxes. I just think we pay too much in taxes. Think about it. We get you from the time you get up till the time you go to bed. The time you get up in the morning, your feet at the floor, you go jump in the shower, we tax your water. You dry off and put your clothes on, we tax your clothes. Eat your breakfast, we tax your breakfast. You go and jump in the car, we tax your car. Stop at the local gas station, get fuel, we tax your fuel. Go to work, we tax your income. Come home in the evening, flop down in a lazy boy, we tax your furniture. Turn the TV on, we tax your cable. Go to bed at night, you fall on your knees and you pray to a true and living God and you get off your knees and you kiss your spouse, you think that's free, but it's not. There's a marriage tax. And then you say, I am sick and tired of being sick and tired of paying taxes. I'll just die. There's a death tax. And I personally think it's unfair for any family to have to face the IRS and the undertaker in the same week. Friends, I never voted for tax relief because of my Republican Party affiliation. I voted for tax relief because I know how real people live. Because I went to the local Walmart on the weekends when I went home. I went to the local IGA and I stood in those grocery lines and my wife would send me to shop for groceries using coupons, trying to save 40 cents on a bottle of Tylenol, 50 cents on a box of cereal. You know, I thought, we're the only ones in the Watts household that used coupons. I turn around, there's people behind me, they've got the same 40 cent coupon to save 40 cents on a bottle of Tylenol. 50 cents on a box of cereal. You see, friends, we don't need more taxes. We need more taxpayers. And how do you create taxpayers? You create an environment for people to invest, to risk their capital, to create opportunity. And you have to allow people the opportunity to make a profit. Profit should not be a bad word to us. I've been in business for myself before. I'm in business for myself today. And friends, I'll be honest with you. I've never gone in the business to create a job. I've always gone in the business to create a profit. If J.C. Watts Companies creates a profit, I'll create a job. But if I can't create a profit, there won't be a job. That's not Republican or Democrat. It's not liberal or conservative. That is just a fact. You want to create opportunity in underserved communities? You want to create opportunity in underdeveloped countries? You want to create opportunities right here at home? How can we say to the rest of the world that democracy and free enterprise, that they are the social and economic development tool for them, if we can't make it work for us right here at home, where the incentives are the reverse of everything that needs to be done to create productive human behavior and wealth? You will create poverty if you allow the reward for welfare and unemployment to be greater than the reward for working and being productive. That's not liberal or conservative. It's not red, yellow, brown, black, or white. That is just a fact. You will create poverty if you allow the families that break up to be great, the reward for the families that break up to be greater than the reward for the families that stay together. You will create poverty. You will create poverty if you allow the reward for the drug dealer or illicit capitalism on the streets to be greater than the reward for the man or woman in this room that will go take a second mortgage on your home and take that $10,000 and say, I've got a product or service I'm going to take to the marketplace and I'm going to create jobs and wealth legally. You allow the reward for the drug dealer to be greater than the reward for the risk taker. You create poverty. And if you really want to expand and deepen poverty, you do this. Weaken the link between effort and reward. Again, friends, we don't like thinking outside the box. We don't like looking at new ways of dealing with old problems. We don't like looking at new ways of governing. Why would we ever encourage, why would the federal government, think about this. Why would the federal government ever say in terms of a welfare system, and I believe there is a role for welfare. I believe we have a moral obligation in this country to assist people that cannot assist themselves. I think there's a role for welfare. But friends, why did the federal government say to poor people, okay, we'll allow you to be on welfare, but you can't save money? Now, how do you get ahead in this country? Two ways to do it. Either you save or you invest. They said you can't save money. 1.8 million inmates in America, and they said, but you can't marry the father of your children. You can't own a home. You can't have a car. You can't have assets. You can't be dependent on your God-given abilities to get out and do for yourself. You have to be dependent on us. 535 people and a president in Washington, D.C. That's who you got to depend on. That's who you got to depend on. You see, we created a system that didn't improve people. It maintained people in poverty. And it was a sick, pathetic system. And contrary to popular belief, most people on welfare didn't want to be on welfare. They didn't want to be there. It wasn't the people in the system. It was the system itself. And we refused for years to change the system. Education, taxes, welfare, health care. I mean, I was talking to Bob Corbin today, and he said that here on campus, Mr. President, you all have a program that you require students to take a wellness class. I mean, think about this, and I've been an advocate of this, of saying, why do we wait and allow somebody to become 65, put them on Medicare, and then they have heart surgery, and you pay $75,000 to $100,000 for the heart surgery? Why not when they're 25 or when they're 30, say, okay, every year that your cholesterol is under 200, we'll give you $500 per year tax credit. But that makes too much sense for Washington. And friends, let me tell you, we have made this much more difficult than it ever should have been. Because we have refused to use common sense. Common sense should say to us, let's reward people for being productive, not being unproductive. You know, let's reward people for being healthy, not being unhealthy. You know, Buddy Watts, my dad, and if you, Jay's heard this story, but and if you've ever heard me speak, you've probably heard me tell this story because I've talked about Buddy Watts all over the country. But my father went to his grave in October of 2000, having spent 2 days in the seventh grade. That was the extent of his education. But you know, friends, I've dined with kings and queens and presidents, but I never met a person smarter than Buddy Watts. Everything that he accomplished in his life was because of his faith and good old-fashioned, you follow Oklahoma common sense. Back in 1981, I was about 30, 40 days from graduating from the University of Oklahoma, and this is a true story. I'd gone home one weekend, and Daddy and I sat in the front room of his house, of his home, there in Eufaula, sobbing, you know, talking about all of America's problems about 2 o'clock in the morning, time to retire. And Daddy said something to me that I'll never forget if I live to be 150 years of age. He said, "You know, Junior," he said, "I think I want to go to that there college." And I kind of chuckled and I said, "Daddy, what are you talking about? You want to go to college? You're 57 years old. You're a double bypass heart patient. Mom is diabetic. You've got these cows, these rental properties. You're pastoring the church. Why are you wanting to go to college?" And he said, "I'd like to see what makes you guys fools after you get out." He said, "You guys seem to lose your ability to use common sense." Friends, it is not as difficult as Republicans or Democrats make it. Illegal immigration. We were talking about illegal immigration in 1995, and you know what? I went to a high school, and then one of the things I did when I was in Congress, I would go to high schools and go to government classes, and I would have town meetings with high school students. We were talking about illegal immigration in 1995. And I talked to this class and we were talking about this and I said, "Okay, what do you guys think we should do about illegal immigration?" This young lady that was in 11th grade, she raised her hand and she said, "Congressman," she said, "I don't understand. If it's illegal, what's the issue?" Duh. Illegal immigration. That's what we're talking about. Illegal immigration. Education, taxes, health care, bureaucracies. Friends, if we are to compete with China and India over the next 25, 30 years, and we are to compete in a global marketplace, our students have to learn more science, they have to learn more math. If we are to compete with China and India over the next 25, 30 years, we're going to have to reform our legal system. We have to reform our tax system. We're going to have to reform the bureaucracies. And you think about the bureaucracies in this country that waste. Hear about in 1998, we'd come up with this idea. And Jay will remember this. I said, you know, we had a $1.8 trillion budget at the time. And we were 18 billion dollars short 3 weeks before the end of the session. We'd made a commitment not to spend the Social Security surplus. There's another novel idea. One of the things we ought to put in the Social Security plan is to say, keep your filthy hands off the money that you put in Social Security for Social Security. That helps as well. But we were $18 billion short and at the end of the year, had to come up with $18 billion. So I came up with what I thought was a pretty decent idea. I said, okay, let's challenge the federal agencies and departments to come up with one penny's worth of savings in their budget. So I organized a press conference and I put up on my little board there about 8 to 10 ideas on what I would do to find one penny's worth of savings in departments and agencies. Simultaneous to my press conference, the Secretary of Education, Secretary of Interior, they had press conferences and they said this: "We don't have 1% waste in our budget." And as they were saying that, I was reading a GAO audit, General Accounting Office audit, that said there were $850 billion in government assets unaccounted for. We lost things like ships. We didn't know where they were. True story. We lost missiles. We didn't know where they were. We have literally reformed or transformed our kitchen more than we have transformed our government. Anybody in this room remember the times that you, if you're 45 years older, if you're probably 40 years older, you remember the old wood stoves? My grandmother used to cook on an old wood stove. Sometimes take things forever to cook. Today we have a microwave. You see, the private sector cooks with microwaves, federal government cooks with wood stoves. We've transformed our kitchen. I was at Best Buy the other night, and you know, I'm not much of a techie, a high tech guy. You know, but you know, I literally went to Best Buy the other night and saw a TV screen on the refrigerator door. And I just kind of walked by it and looked at it like it was had leprosy. So I'm not used to seeing a TV screen on my refrigerator door. I went to Washington. And how many of you today have Blackberries? A few. When I went to Washington in 1995, Blackberry was a fruit. Today it's this platform that's got email and telephone and all these different components to it. You see, that's what happens in the private sector. Friends, you think about it. We can't continue to sustain the greatness of America. And we can't continue to be the leader of the free world using the current systems and models that we're using. We can. I love American history. I love studying history during that pre-Reconstruction time. And prior to 1865, when I was a senior, when I was a junior, the sophomore at the University of Oklahoma, I took a history class, and I had this old history professor that his hair wasn't gray, it was white. And Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, he would stand before our class, and he would always have a pipe in his mouth and never be lit. He'd just have a pipe, and he'd be chewing on that pipe. And man, he'd make history come alive right there in that classroom. And I took an interest in history and studied history. And I love reading about history during, especially the Abraham Lincoln days. And, you know, Abraham Lincoln, no president had to lead in the difficult times or in times that were as difficult as it were under Abraham Lincoln's leadership and his presidency. When we were literally that close. Falling apart as a nation. Friends, we've endured much in this great nation. Civil wars, segregation. We've endured much. But you know, when you study American history, you know, I mentioned immigration. I have less problems with the border than I do the classroom. Anybody that wants to come to this country and pay taxes and be productive, I have no problem with that. But I think there's things that we have to learn about America, about being an American. The institutions, the good, the bad, the history of our country, the things that has gotten us to where we are today. You can't be an American by leaving one foot in one country and one foot in America. I pledge allegiance to the United States of America. But you see, we don't teach American history anymore. We don't talk about the institutions, the foundations. We don't talk about the sacrifices that men and women, red, yellow, brown, black, and white, that they made to make America what it is today. You see, we've got a segment of it. We've got many in the academic community that they say that we are programming kids. I don't call it programming. I just call it American history. And it seems as though that when we look at American history and we look at where we are today, it seems as though we are trying so hard to adopt, when you look at world history, trying to adopt what Europe has done over the last 35, 40 years. especially the European leadership. I believe there are many Europeans that they believe the way we believe and they agree with us. But that old liberal elite European model that they have adopted five things, and friends, if we adopt them in America, I guarantee you it is a formula for what I call graceful decay. And you look at world history, the liberal elite in Washington, I mean, in Europe, what they have adopted, they've every year, almost every year, they raise taxes, cut benefits. That's part of the formula for graceful decay. Raise taxes, cut benefits. And the other three things is, don't defend yourself. Define marriage outside of one man, one woman. And the fifth thing is, remove God from all public life. That is a formula for graceful decay. Raise taxes, cut benefits, don't defend yourself in times of war. Define marriage outside of one man, one woman. Remove God from all public life. Friends, I am a person of faith. Everything that I've accomplished in my life has been because of my faith and my education. And I believe that Christ died for the homosexual just like he died for the heterosexual. But friends, let me tell you something. There is no superior model, no superior model to one man and one woman in a child's life. We have said, I was a youth pastor for 8 years. And in poor communities, poor white communities, poor black communities, poor Hispanic communities, we have tried to encourage those kids as to what marriage and what family is all about. And in 2003, 69% of kids born black community were born to single-parent homes. Those statistics are high in poor white communities, poor Hispanic communities, other poor communities as well. But you know what we've said to those kids in the red, yellow, brown, black, and white community, what family and marriage was all about? And now all of a sudden we're about to change the model on them, change the definition. We will wreak havoc on our communities. Am I against single-parent families? No, I'm not. Thank God for those moms in my neighborhood. Put their foot down. Stood tall when that man didn't stand up and take his rightful place in the home, in the community. But as I said, there's no superior model to a man and a woman playing a role in a child's life. No superior model. Remove God from all public life as I close. Friends, when we allow judges, the more we allow judges to remove God from all public life, the more we weaken the fabric of America. 91% of the American people believe that under God should be in the pledge. 91%. But you've got judges in the Ninth Circuit of California that said, we're going to decide for 91% of the American people, and we're going to side with that 9%. and remove under God from the pledge. 91%. Friends, we are not a nation divided on values. We are a nation divided on ugly partisan politics. This place that you and I call home, and the rest of the world calls America, it's a pretty special place. It's a pretty special place. And as I think more on a daily basis about the kind of future that I want for my kids and my grandkids, when you ask yourself the question, what do you want? What kind of future do you want for your kids and for your grandkids? You can't help but ask yourself the question, what are we going to do to equal that World War II generation? To keep our country safe, to keep our country free, to keep our country prosperous, to keep our country healthy. And oh, by the way, that formula for graceful decay, don't defend yourself. When evil people say they will do evil things to the United States of America, we better take them seriously. This is a war. This is a fight to the end. And I've got a pretty simple philosophy. They lose, we win.